Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Dish with Dina podcast. I am so happy to have you join us. Today, my guest is Amanda Settle, a fellow registered dietitian who specializes in all things related to gut health. Amanda and I dish about her background as a ballet dancer, the challenges that come with managing a gastrointestinal disorder, and how to encourage our clients to be patient as they navigate their diagnoses. Just a quick disclaimer and reminder that the information shared in these episodes is intended for your general knowledge only and is not a substitute for medical advice or treatment for specific medical conditions. Please be sure to seek prompt, qualified medical advice for any specific health issues and consult your physician or healthcare practitioner before starting any kind of self-directed treatment. So sit back, enjoy the conversation, and let's dish. Welcome, Amanda Settle, to the Dish with Dina podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be with me.
And thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to just do a quick disclaimer for anyone who's watching this on our YouTube channel that we both have cats. We're both cat mamas. You may or may not see some furry creatures walking past us. They are part of this discussion just as much as we are. So we're just going to acknowledge that and move on. So Amanda, you were one of the very kind souls who reached out and accepted my request to be on this podcast. And you're also a dietitian like I am. So let me ask you a little bit about your history of how you became involved in this profession.
Sure. So I actually grew up I was in ballet from the time I was 4 years old. So nutrition was always really important to me because, you know, you have to remain thin, however strong, and be able to have the energy to get through performances. And so nutrition was always a very strong interest for me. And so when I discovered the field of dietetics, I was so thrilled. And I interned with a dietitian in private practice when I was in high school. And I was like, this is what I want to do. This is my dream job. And so I was one of the fortunate people that knew exactly what I wanted to do when I went to college and was in and out in 4 years.
This has come up a couple of times with some of the other dietitians that I've spoken to, where it's very surprising to me because I am a second careerer. I don't even know if I knew what a dietitian was at an earlier age. So I'm really excited to know that there are some people who have discussions with, relationships with, are told about the value of what we can bring to not just when you are performing an athlete or in some sort of specific area of expertise in that way, but also just general guidance and help, and of course, managing chronic conditions. And so we'll definitely talk a little bit more because I want to find out too about being in that particular environment and the pressures placed upon you, as you mentioned, to be of a certain image, body image, shape, size, but also the performance capabilities too of what you had to do to maintain that. But let's first talk a little bit about some of your current areas of expertise. Is there anything in particular that you're focusing on or that you happen to have a particular client population?
Yeah, it's a little bit twofold for me at the moment. So I really, when I started my private practice it's been almost 5 years ago now. And it kind of started out where I was very part-time and now this is my full-time job. And I was seeing more and more clients having a lot of gut issues. So whether it is food sensitivities or a celiac or irritable bowel syndrome, it seemed like it was becoming more and more prevalent. So with my IBS clients in particular, I noticed that when we really focused on that dietary protocol for IBS, it made such a difference in their quality of life. And to me, that was just so rewarding. It wasn't not that things like weight loss or, you know, controlling diabetes is, you know, I mean, any less exciting when you kind of get things under control and are well managed, but this was just such a huge quality of life change for these clients. And so it was so rewarding, both for them and for me as well. And so that's where I kind of veered more towards focusing on gut health. But also I would say at least half of my clients still continue to come to me for weight loss. But sometimes both too. So I tell my clients, a lot of them with IBS are like, hey, you know, I want to get these symptoms under control and, you know, get a hold of this. However, like, can we also work on some weight loss? And I'm like, yes, we can kill two birds with one stone. It is possible.
I want us to define or clarify some of the gut distinctions. So IBS, what you're talking about is irritable bowel syndrome, if I'm not mistaken. That is like the ruling out of many other things. And can you share a little bit about what kind of symptoms come with that and how does it differ from other gut health conditions?
Right. That's a great question. So with irritable bowel syndrome, the symptoms can vary from kind of more diarrhea based or constipation, more on the constipation side, or it could be a mix of both. So sometimes it is a little bit of a challenge to diagnose because there is a lot of overlap with a lot of other conditions, inflammatory bowel diseases like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, SIBO, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, celiac disease. So there's a lot of overlap with a lot of these other conditions. And so it is like you mentioned, it is kind of a process of elimination, unfortunately. So it's not always really easy to diagnose. And it's very commonly underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed. So I think that's why, you know, and a lot of people go undiagnosed for a very long time. And maybe that's kind of been their norm, which is hard, but sometimes it just becomes too difficult to manage. And then they're like, okay, I need to go to the doctor and figure out what is going on.
And as you said, with the treatment plan of focusing on repairing their gut health, but also figuring out what may or may not trigger those flare-ups or those episodes, I understand, and having had gastrointestinal issues myself in the past, I understand there's also a lot of, you know, brain gut connections too. The things that you might be stressing out over could be causing some complications in your gut, and the fact that your gut is not healed or it is not digesting things properly or metabolizing things properly can cause stress. So now you become foggy in the brain, or, you know, you get a little bit frustrated with all that. And there could be situations too, Amanda, correct me if I'm wrong, that can cause a little bit of disordered eating in that there's social anxiety, or I'm going to eat something and it's going to make me feel really uncomfortable. And especially when it comes to discomfort, bloating, abdominal cramps, diarrhea, constipation, people don't want to be in that situation when they are not at home. So can you share a little bit too about some of the challenges once somebody is diagnosed with that of, you know, the kind of the journey that they take of slowly healing, but what are some of the situations that happen or that you also have to help them through that might not be nutritionally based in behavioral ways?
Right. And you bring up a very good point, because when I kind of mentioned earlier about that it's such a quality of life issue, I've had several clients that either travel for work or whatever, and they just don't eat all day because they're like, I'm going to be on an airplane. I can't necessarily always get up to use the bathroom. Or same thing with even certain jobs where maybe they don't, especially people who work in healthcare, and maybe you're in the OR. You can't just say, hey, I gotta leave the surgery. I gotta go to the bathroom. And so, like you said, with disordered eating, sometimes I've had several clients that either only eat a very few select foods or just fast through the entire day so that they don't have to worry about those symptoms. And so with the protocol that I take them through, we can identify the specific foods that are triggering their symptoms so that they can go back to a slightly more normal way of eating once we're kind of through the whole program. And so then it's kind of eases their mind a little bit too, because they're not constantly having anxiety about eating in general. They know kind of what their like safe foods are, that they know that they can tolerate that are maybe not going to trigger symptoms. But it is kind of twofold, like you said, because of that gut brain connection, that anxiety, stress, all of those things can also trigger symptoms. So, which, you know, it's kind of like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Was it the impaired gut health that caused the anxiety? Was the anxiety that caused the impaired gut health? So it's a two-way street.
Let's talk a little bit about the approach, if you don't mind sharing. There is a first form of treatment for specifically for IBS. And I mentioned to you before we hit record that sometimes certain health care professionals who are not dietitians, or even some who are but might not be familiar with the approach of taking it, it can feel like a very extreme approach, but it really is some form of trial and error, I would maybe put in that particular wording, but walk us through a little bit about what the approach is and how you define it.
Right. And you're exactly right. Pretty much all of my IBS clients that I have worked with have said that they were diagnosed and they were either just told, if it bothers you, don't eat it. Or they were given just kind of a one page handout of, hey, here's a list of foods that might bother you. And that's about the only guidance that they receive. And I understand that a little bit, because the whole concept and a lot of the research that have been done on these FODMAP foods, that it's really kind of a newer and growing science. So this really kind of started more in the early 2000s, and I don't want to age myself, but I'd already graduated college when a lot of this whole concept of a low FODMAP diet was introduced. And so it's something that a lot of doctors, mid-levels, even dietitians, are not that familiar with, because a lot of us did not learn about that in school. So Monash University in Australia, they're the ones that are kind of the leaders in all of this research. And so it's still constantly evolving, and we're learning more and more about these foods. But they have developed a fairly specific protocol. And so the first 4 weeks are a little bit stringent. We basically remove all of those high FODMAP foods. And I guess I should kind of pause and clarify for anyone who is not familiar with FODMAPs. That is a kind of a long acronym, and it stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. So long story short, I know that was a lot of really big words for anyone who is not in the healthcare field, but basically what that means is that these are types of carbohydrates. And what happens in IBS, in an IBS condition, is that our body, for whatever reason, does not adequately process these carbohydrates, are not digested, and they move into the large intestine, where they just kind of ferment. And that's what kind of triggers the gas, bloating, distension, just all of those uncomfortable symptoms, and then results in either diarrhea, constipation, or that mix of both. So that being said, kind of going back to the elimination phase, we eliminate all of the foods that are high in FODMAPs. And so kind of basically what we're doing with that is we're allowing the gut to rest a little bit. We're reducing all of that inflammation. And once those kind of first 4 weeks are over, then we go into a reintroduction stage. So we reintroduce each carbohydrate one at a time. And there's a very specific kind of protocol for that as well, as far as what type of food and how much and for how many days. So we'll get into all the details on that. But basically, we're introducing one a week. So that ends up being about an 8 to 10 week process. I've had some clients that are like, hey, I know that I am, you know, very sensitive to gluten or garlic or something. And they're like, I don't even want to test that. So I do let my clients kind of steer the ship a little bit in that regard. But we reintroduce each one. And so then we can kind of, the last couple of weeks of the program, we can really kind of liberalize their diet again, knowing what foods and how much of a particular food can trigger those symptoms. So that gives them a much more, a lot more variety of things to eat, maybe versus how they were eating before and just completely restricting everything. So it really kind of allows them to maybe learn how to choose foods when they go out to eat with family or friends, or, kind of enjoy life again, and not just kind of be eating some of the same foods over and over again. But of course, during all of this, we're also focusing on sleep and stress and some of those other factors that can contribute to symptoms. So it's a very involved process, but like I said, the difference that it makes in these clients is absolutely amazing.
You bring up so many good points. First of all, as dietitians, you mentioned earlier, a lot of us didn't even understand what some of the gut health conditions might be. And if you're working in an outpatient setting, even more so, because there's so many nuances to lifestyle habits, sleeping, right, smoking, stress conditions, et cetera. A couple of things I wanted to share with the listeners too is when you hear the word FODMAP and how Amanda just also defined the terms of it, it is carbohydrate foods. Your body naturally does certain things in its gut, but in the case of somebody with IBS, it's more to the extreme where it's causing that after effect or those symptoms to happen. But it's fairly normal, right, Amanda, that like when we eat something that is starchy or carbohydrate dense, we can get a little bloated, a little gassy, but it's really that point where it's not, you know, if it's a diagnosable condition, then we're going to implement this low FODMAP approach. Not that everybody with a little tummy gut issue, or if you're feeling a little gassy, are going to completely cut things out, because the top contenders are garlic and onions and apples and like so many great foods that we don't want to get rid of completely, but there are definitely workarounds. And then the other thing I wanted to ask also with the elimination and the reintroduction too, because that is a very specific protocol. So again, if you are listening to this, if you have not been referred to a dietitian and you've just been giving a list of don't eat these things ever, it's a very restrictive approach and it's not correct. Like, we want to make sure that you have the flexibility to take the time to understand what might cause those flare-ups. And then, as Amanda said, right, you're reintroducing a certain amount at a time in a certain amount of a time so that you're not completely getting rid of some of these really nutrient dense, good for you quality foods. So thank you for explaining that. And once again, advocating for the value of a dietitian when it comes to these things. Yes. Amanda, is there anything that you see as far as trial and error goes? You mentioned, you know, it's kind of like an 8 to 10, it could be an 8 to 10 week protocol. Do some people suffer more dire consequences? Could they have been misdiagnosed? Could the treatment plan not work for them? Does it feel like at one point they just go, forget it, I'll just deal with the pain and suffering, like it's not worth it anymore? You know, I guess how can we soften our approach or just prepare people for this could be something that could work, not work, or it might feel a little bit time consuming or frustrating to try to get to that end result?
Right. And I do kind of let people know from the get go. I'm like, hey, this is going to be, it's 16 weeks. I said, it's not going to be easy. But the idea is that this is kind of a one-time thing. So I'm like, I know it's going to be hard, but I'm like, I'm here to support you every step of the way. But it is very intense. It's pretty stringent. However, the reward at the end is so great. And I have only really had one client that really struggled to see a lot of difference, but I think that she has some other things going on, and I ended up referring her back to her GI doctor because I thought there's something else going on here. But all of my other clients, it's so amazing to see the progress that they make.
I love that. And again, we as specialists ourselves who want people to be referred to us, we also, as Amanda just said, we're also aware that sometimes certain things are a little bit outside of our scope, or we're not able to understand the nuances of things. So we definitely want you working with other specialists or therapists too, a social worker, people who can help you support any kind of behavioral triggers or anything that might be socioeconomically related as well, case workers, social workers, like I said, that, you know, that might be outside of what we can do. And that's something too, also diving in a little bit with potentially with any of the restrictions or disordered eating patterns, if it's not coming from the discussion we're having in our session, I will always, you know, kind of cue up somebody and say, I think this might be a little bit bigger than what we have going on here. There might be some control issues or lack of control issues, and that might be something you want to discuss with the therapist. So, you know, as I said before, sometimes our healthcare professional colleagues and counterparts are not necessarily trained in nutrition. Dietitians are not necessarily psychiatrists and psychologists. So please make sure that you are aware that we might want to have you reach out to other people to be part of your support team.
Exactly. And I will say, I refer a lot back and forth with a pelvic floor physical therapist, because a lot of times it is kind of twofold. So it may be that not only is there some dysfunction in the pelvic floor, but also some of those things are being triggered by things in our food. So we definitely work very closely with our clients. And I think having kind of both the nutrition aspect and the pelvic floor therapy aspect has really kind of, it really, you know, helps them improve much quicker.
I didn't even think of that, because hello, everything's in that general vicinity that, you know, the neck bone is related to the knee bone in some form or fashion. Everything is really so interrelated. That's fascinating to do some whatever exercises or therapy movements they have for that could potentially also support while they're undergoing the low FODMAP approach, but also maybe eliminate entirely some of those symptoms or complications that they're having. Thank you, Amanda, for sharing that. Is there anything that you have come across? You and I are on social media somewhat, right? Are you very involved in posting things online or reading things on there? You may know where I'm going with this question. You know, while it's a great platform for us to be able to share our expertise, we often come across a lot of misinformation, disinformation, disputes, counter arguments. What have, and it could be, you know, it could be in real life or on social media, Amanda, however you want to address this question, but what might be some of the current hot topics or things that either get you going in a positive or negative way that you might want to just share with our listeners?
Yeah, I think it's kind of that ongoing issue of fad diets and misinformation. I think that, and honestly, that's one of the reasons that my business partner and I kind of started this business in the first place was we want to create a space where our friends, family, anybody else can come and get evidence-based nutrition information, not just what's the latest fad diet or, you know, whatever kind of gimmick is out there, but giving sound information and also realistic, because it's not all about I feel like everything is to the extreme anymore. And whether it's, you know, like the 75 hard or keto or, you know, it's like all these extremes. And that really, honestly, in the long run, sets a lot of people up for failure. So just trying to kind of give a space for sound nutrition information.
I appreciate that. This comes up a lot. I mean, obviously, as dietitians, we want to support whatever anybody wants in their journey, but we want to make sure you're doing it in a realistic and sustainable approach. So since we have some time, let's talk a little bit more about that, right? The fad diets, the restrictive approaches, but also in the other direction too. I also work with some athletes because I'm the campus dietitian at school. So some of them need to make weight or put on weight. And let's go back to the discussion about your ballet time of life. Are you still engaged in that as a form of physical activity or just, you know, movement?
Yes. Well, yeah. Kind of. I actually teach ballet here locally in the city where I live. But also the most exciting is that I am the official dietitian for the Tulsa Ballet. So I grew up, I was a trainee with the Tulsa Ballet way back in the day. And so now I get to be their dietitian, which is amazing. So I get to go in person a couple times throughout the year and work one-on-one with the dietitian or with the ballet dancers. And it's just, it's so great. It's so rewarding that I get to kind of combine my two loves of ballet and nutrition. It's amazing. So yeah, that's like a whole other kind of like you working with the athletes. That's kind of a whole other side of nutrition of, hey, how can we build muscle? How can we maybe put on weight or, you know, making sure that they eat enough to sustain rehearsals and performances and all of that. So yeah, it's so much fun.
And as I said before, we hit record as well. Like, you know, we are in the profession of being dietitians, but we're also human people who might be patients with conditions of our own. And same thing with athletes, same things with anybody in other fields is that you're still a human person. So what is some of the guidance or maybe misguidance that you have seen, especially within the ballet world? And how are you able to correct that and encourage people to take a more healthful approach while maintaining their agility, their ability, their performance.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it is, it's kind of with, especially with ballet, I feel like you are kind of walking a very fine line because they do have to maintain a very, you know, thin physique for the females. And of course for the males, you know, being able to lift the girls and all of that. So it's a very fine line. But a lot of what I do too is if the, cause some of the dancers come to me and they're like, hey, I'm getting really fatigued during rehearsals. You know, usually about this time during the day. And so we kind of take a look at what they're eating and seeing if there's any deficiencies, or sometimes I do have them go and have like their B12 levels or iron levels checked. Because there, you know, there is some restrictive eating. You're going to have that with a professional ballet company. And so it's making them look at food as fuel versus anything negative. And sometimes that's, you know, that change doesn't happen overnight. And that really goes for anybody, not just athletes, but kind of looking at food in a different light as this is fuel, kind of like our cars, you know, if we don't put gas in them, they don't go. Same thing. If we don't put quality nutrient dense foods in our bodies are not going to perform to the optimal level that we want them to.
I love that and use that analogy all the time. I work with a lot of students, as I said just before, with being the campus nutritionist. So obviously students that are going from class to class and have, you know, five different things that they're running back and forth to. When they stop in to see me, the first thing that I will ask them when they say stuff like, I'm exhausted, I'm like, well, have you eaten? Like, coffee is not a meal. Like, you can't just have a Dunkin' Donuts latte and think that that's going to nourish you and sustain you in that way too. So we definitely encourage caloric intake, nutritionally dense foods to make sure that you're meeting all of your requirements. And yes, of course, there is, you know, flexibility in enjoying the fun stuff too, but making sure that you provide your body with the energy that it needs to go from place to place and not just, you know, completely go without anything. And then at the end of the day, you're starving, like you're, you know, finishing all the meal at 8 o'clock at night and then going right to bed, which is not the best thing for your body either, to try to get a good night's sleep while you're digesting, you know, a whole day's worth of food. Amanda, talk to me about your current, or I guess I was going to say typical, but sometimes it's not typical. What's a current week in the life of you? Like, what are the things that you're managing in the professional space too, but how are you also balancing your own personal needs?
That's a great question. Sometimes I don't know that I have really great balance. I'm working on it. It's been a lot better since I quit my other 9-to-5 job and am able just to focus on my private practice now. But yes, I do juggle a lot between being a mom and a business owner and all my clients, ballet teacher. I wear a lot of different hats, but I love them all. So yes, I do kind of have trouble with saying no to things. I want to do all the things but yes, I make it work, but yeah, it can be a challenge from time to time. And then, like you said, with self-care too, even as dietitians, we know the importance of exercise and eating healthy and all of that. But once you kind of get into a good routine with things, then that definitely helps. I loved your podcast episode about meal planning, because that's something that I really preach to all of my clients, and it can look differently for different people. It doesn't necessarily have to be that you make all of your meals on the one day. It can look a little bit differently, but honestly, that's really what helps to set us up for success during the week, especially when we are, you know, working a full-time job and a mom and, you know, volunteering and just doing all the things. It really does help to set people up for success, especially if they have, you know, certain dietary needs, whether it's a sensitivity or IBS or diabetes, you know, whatever that looks like, that really does help to then not only, you know, make life a little bit more manageable, but also keeping, you know, staying on top of our health.
Obviously, since you just plugged the meal planning thing, I'm a huge advocate for that. I have also mentioned too, there could be some flexibility in there. And if anybody saw my live tour of my kitchen in my New York City apartment, I don't have the ability to batch cook and buy, you know, bulk amounts of things. It's very day to day. So depending on what anybody's approach is, their finances, et cetera, but especially if you're dealing with chronic conditions or food adherences, food preferences, food issues, allergies, et cetera, that it really does. It takes the decision-making part out of it when you are looking at that whole week at a glance or even just a few days at a glance. So I love that approach. I'm a huge advocate, however we define that. A couple of things you mentioned that I wanted to share, because I just came across some guidance for myself as I'm always trying to better and improve and lead and live by example. I also like to juggle many, many things. So one of the things I heard recently was, you can do anything, but you can't do everything. Yes. So that hit me hard, because I am entering into a new stage of life. This might be, you know, the second half of my life, if I am fortunate enough to live another 20 or 30 years, that I have to really reassess, like, where am I putting all of my energy? And yet I still want to be involved in so many things. So that's one of the things I want to ask you in a second. The other thing too, you mentioned about balance, and one of the phrases that I just came across, and I can't remember who said this, that it's not about striving for balance anymore, because we think of balance as if it's 50-50 split, but more about harmony. So it's okay, especially if you are, whatever, juggling family, juggling entrepreneurship, it's okay if a lot more of your focus is on one thing, but just make sure that you're still including those other things, that you're not letting all that stuff go off the sides there.
Yeah.
In your private practice, do you have a cap of how many people you can see because they are on a particular protocol? And my follow-up question is also insurance-based or self-pay. Does that also, you know, kind of hinder how many people you can or cannot see?
Great question. Yeah, I am self-pay. I do not go through insurance. It's been pretty good for the most part. I have had some people call and are interested in my services, but then say basically no, because I don't accept insurance. I do let people know though, that I can print off a super bill. I have people that pay with their HSA. So if you have that health savings, that's one way to kind of go about it as well. So there are a lot of options. But yeah, insurance based, it's just, I've had other providers say, if you don't accept insurance, don't start. So
it is so tricky. We've definitely had conversations in some of the previous episodes, but I always like to reiterate, I take some insurance. I don't take all insurance, but even depending on the particular condition, even if somebody is sent to me by their doctor, depending on their insurance, they might be limited to 3 sessions. And just like Amanda said, like, that's not going to help us get from point A to point B when I really need to help educate you. I need you to test things out. I need you to come back and give me feedback on things. So we end up, unfortunately, spreading out instead of meeting every week or every 2 weeks. We meet once a month just so they can get their 3 visits in that are covered. And of course, same as you, if they end up having to do co-pays or out of pocket, self-pay, if I don't take their insurance at all, or they don't have insurance, you know, I can offer some sliding scale, some issues with my students. I might have a couple of pro bono sessions, but your girl's got to pay the bills. So I have to make sure, I have to make sure that I can't be giving everything away for free, unfortunately. But I do a lot of things like workshops and webinars. And Amanda, especially for you, since you do have so many things going on, do you do speaking engagements? Are you asked to present in places, whether you're getting paid for your time and, you know, expertise or not? Are you able to do some other things that are, you know, just kind of keep you going and get the word out there to market yourself or, again, advocate for the value of a dietitian?
Absolutely. And I do both. I do free speaking events where, and then I just, it's usually kind of a shorter amount of time. I don't offer as much actual education, more so kind of, hey, this is who I am. This is what I do. This is how I can help. But yes, absolutely. Classes. I mentioned the pelvic floor physical therapist earlier. We actually have a combined class about IBS and the pelvic floor. So that's a class we have coming up locally, but we're also streaming it through Zoom. So I do classes, I do master classes, kind of same, because really I want to, like, I, you know, yes, again, this is my income. However, I also just want to make sure that the public is educated by, you know, by the real, the accurate information and not just the next fad that's out there.
Exactly. And so this brings me to my follow-up question about that is, you mentioned earlier that you had just quit your job and now you're focusing more on building your practice and doing some other things that you had been wanting to do. You might not have had the time to do. Where is the future of you going?
That is a great, great question. So I would say the majority of my business currently is local. I do have a brick and mortar office. This is my home office, but I have an actual office here in town. But I do a lot of virtual as well. So I contract with a couple of different clinics, kind of somewhat locally, also in Oklahoma and in Florida. So I get to do a lot of virtual. Now, eventually I would like for more of my practice to be virtual, just for the sake of either traveling or, once my kids are out of the house, maybe moving. So trying to get into a little bit more of that virtual space, especially because of what I do, the work that I do with irritable bowel syndrome. There's just so many people that really need that guidance. And there are not a lot of dietitians that specialize in IBS. So, eventually I'm going to be having a group program. So right now I'm doing it all on an individual basis. But eventually I am going to kind of move towards a group, just for, mostly so I can see more clients at one time, get more in. Cause yes, like you said, we do have a cap as to how many patients we can actually see in 1 week. But also to help cut cost. So, you know, like you said, we have to make money. You know, our services are, you know, what I feel like are very reasonable. However, that's not always doable for everyone based on their income. So this would allow for a slightly less expensive route to go. And some people also like the idea of the group setting where they have that support system. So there's just so many benefits to doing group education. And so that's something that I'm hopefully going to be starting. My goal is to kind of launch that during Gut Health Month in April. So that'll be coming down the pipeline.
I love that approach. I worked for a community health center and also did a couple of things on my own here where we had a year-long group program for preventing type 2 diabetes, and the people were fantastic. And like Amanda said, you get a lot more literal bang for your buck and also figurative bang for your buck there too, because you're hearing for the expertise from the person who is your healthcare professional, but also you get to hear other people's stories. And I think that alleviates you from feeling so isolated and frustrated, and also saying like, oh, you know, other people are quite literally feeling the same things I'm feeling in whatever my condition is, my diagnosis is. And just, again, spreading ourselves a little too thin with only being able to meet one-on-one administrative things, in my case, or maybe your case too, paperwork that follow anything, following up and creating things and updating our materials, and also just having to make sure that we are adhering in the profession that we're in as dietitians, we have to maintain continuing education units and professional development and that sort of thing. So we have to plug that in and pay for those items as well. So there's only so much you can do in 168 hours, everybody, right? So I love that you can coordinate a group setting, whether it's a dozen or 200, like whatever it is that the outreach is, that is, I'm heading in that direction too. I really have been working on trying to get more, maybe even online courses done. I keep promoting them. For 6 years, I've been teasing it, and I'm like, I'll eventually get to it. But it really does. It alleviates us from having to, you know, it's brain power. It's a lot of brain power. And also just the counseling aspect of it also, Amanda, you know, a lot of what we share isn't just here's some stuff, read it and go away. It's about really understanding the challenges that we have with our patient discussions and the behavioral factors, like we mentioned before, of how we can support somebody. A lot of times people might come to our sessions where we expect to have a follow-up visit or a follow-up discussion, and something may have just happened in their life that really veers the discussion, and we're there to support them however we can, but that can be quite draining to have that happen over and over again. Whereas in a group, again, you have that camaraderie, that support. So good luck with that. I'm excited to see where this direction leads you. Yes. Amanda, with the handful of minutes that we have left in our conversation, I want to find out if there is anything that did not come up in our discussion, anything that I might have forgotten to ask you that you'd like to share.
I feel like we covered a lot.
I'm good at what I do. I keep my notes, right. And I'm trying to keep track. And I really think there was, I mean, you know, listen, if we had unending, unlimited amount of time, I could probably go on and on and talk forever about a lot of things. I think what I want to find out from you is in the next iteration of what you're doing, as far as like materials are concerned too, do you have anything, resources available on, of course, I'm going to include your website and where people can find you on social media, but anything that's like downloadable resources, just to kind of educate people if they're not yet ready to commit to making an appointment, or you're not ready just yet for the group discussion, is there something that you have available that they can read through that comes from you?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that, because I did kind of want to plug that as well as another resource. Number one, I do have a private Facebook group that is specific for women with IBS and other gut issues. I kept it to women, you know, not that the men are not important. However, women, and one thing I didn't mention earlier is that hormones can also affect our gut motility at times. So I just wanted kind of a safe space for women to be able to maybe discuss constipation during their period or things like that, that maybe they're not as comfortable discussing around men. So it is a great Facebook group. It's growing. I pop in live once a week. There's a free, I have like a 1 day kind of sample meal, like kind of a, like a 1 day meal plan that is low FODMAP. So that's just kind of a good tool to kind of get people started. I also strongly recommend using the Monash app, or even the Monash University website, because they are the leaders in the FODMAP research, this app is going to be the most up-to-date. They also have a list of dietitians all over the world that have gone through the Monash low FODMAP training. So like what I have. So it's nice so that if you're not maybe, you know, as keen on virtual visits, you can find a dietitian more locally to do the one-on-one. So I think that that's just such a good resource. There's recipes in there. It tells you all the list of the you know, foods that can, that are high in FODMAPs, or even ones that are low in FODMAPs, so that you know, okay, well, this might be a safer food. So there's a lot of really great information, and they update it regularly.
I actually use it as a resource for myself because of my own issues, but also if anybody has questions on it. I love everything that you shared. I also think this speaks to the more specific training that we do get, right? So we have the, obviously the nationally recognized credential of being a dietitian, but then you'll see people who have specialties in diabetes education or extra training, like Amanda, in anything that has to do with irritable bowel syndrome and that low FODMAP approach. Not that you have to seek out everyone who is specifically trained, because sometimes, again, these things cost money for us to add these extra letters to our titles, and there might be people few and far between, but the point is that if you are struggling with trying to try and error, and you're working with people who are not necessarily steering you in the right direction, it really does benefit you as the patient to empower yourself, to ask the right questions, to ask to be referred to somebody, or like Amanda is giving, the resources that you can go to that have a directory available so you know you're in safe hands. I really appreciate that, Amanda. Thank you. All right. My final two questions, my friend, are, I mean, it's a two-part question. So it is, what is on your plate today, Amanda? When we are done with our discussion, it's still kind of early in the morning on a Saturday at the time of this recording. What is the next thing that you're going to be working on? And then what is the next thing that you're going to be eating?
The next, I actually haven't even had breakfast yet. So probably my protein shake, I'm not going to lie. As far as things that I'm working on, like I said, I have a couple of upcoming classes, one of the IBS and the pelvic floor. So that, along with the therapist, and then I'm going to be traveling to Tulsa the following week to work, number one, with the professional dancers, but number two, with some student dancers. So I'm giving a nutrition presentation to a ballet studio locally. So I have a few classes coming up, and then a masterclass online probably sometime in March. So those are kind of like the big things coming down the pipeline.
Oh my gosh. I love that. I love that. Well, it has been a true pleasure getting to know you, learn more about you. And also now I can add you to my circle of colleagues and friends. Okay. And I can't wait to keep conversation going. I really appreciate the time that you spent with me today. Thank you, Amanda.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining me this week on the Dish with Dina podcast. I am Dina D'Alessandro, registered dietitian, nutritionist, founder, and chief executive life changer at Dish with Dina, and I'm also your host. If you like what you heard, I would be so grateful if you could subscribe to this podcast, leave a review, and share this with others who you think might benefit from what we have to offer on these episodes. You can also join my mailing list at dishwithdina.com or email me at info@dishwithdina.com with questions, comments, feedback, and if you'd like to be a guest on a future episode, because everybody eats and we all have a story to share. I hope you tune back in next week when we dish again.